You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here, founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And as the APN takes a break this holiday season, we'd like to use this opportunity to bring you episodes from other shows that you may not be aware of. Today is from the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And this episode is entitled Kimberly Rockart with Dr. Damien Finch. Kimberly Rockart is in Australia. It's a pretty interesting episode. Check it out and subscribe to the Rock Art Podcast anywhere you find podcasts. You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome out there in Archaeology Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. This is episode 144, and we are really blessed and honored to have Dr. Damien Finch from Australia, Melbourne, Australia, at the university there, who is their honored academic scholar in the area of archaeological chronology, if you haven't. Damien, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Alan.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you all the way from Australia. Fantastic. How exciting for us. And again, it is truly an honor to have you on.
And exciting for me, too, to see interest from all over the world. That's fantastic.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. Now, the way I kick this off is I ask you the million-dollar question. How'd you ever get involved with archaeology and your academic niche? And how did it come about? And what was its evolution?
For me, it was a sort of a later in life development, if you like. I'd retired from an earlier sort of long career in an unrelated field. And a friend convinced myself and my wife to go on a bushwalk in the Kimberley region in Western Australia, which is, if you're in Melbourne, which is down the bottom right-hand corner, it's in the far top left corner. So from the southeast up. The Kimberley's up in the northwest. And for us, it's considered a very sort of remote region. So we embarked on a three-week bushwalk up in that area, and I just became intrigued with the landscape. It was just such a captivating experience. And the thing that did amaze me was that no matter where we went, and we went in some very remote areas, we saw rock art, painted rock art in particular, on the walls of open rock shelters pretty much everywhere that we walked, or not everywhere, but quite frequently. And that was something I was completely unaware of, and I've lived in this country my whole life, but it was news to me.
What kind of rock art was it? Could you give us a word picture, if you would?
Now I'm coloured by the subsequent sort of 15 years of experience, I guess, but at the time, to me it just seemed like a very faint sort of paintings in a reddy brown ochre, and I couldn't really discern the subject matter so much until we went to one particular region where the preservation was just fantastic, and it was in a style that I now know to be the second oldest style of Kimberley rock art, which is sort of really enigmatic human figures with all sorts of decorations around their ankles and elbows and long headdresses. And I was absolutely stunned to see this rock art. I'd never seen anything like it before.
So you had your initial exploration. You are suitably impressed. Where did you go from there?
So that was 2010. So in 2011, we signed up for another walk, and this one was an even more remote region, same area in the Kimberley in Western Australia. But for this one, it's a national park with no public roads leading into the national park. So there's a group of us that jumped in a float plane and landed on the Drysdale River, a long stretch of this big river in the region. And they threw us out with our packs and food and that sort of thing. And we're walking for the next 2 weeks. And again, the art in this region, which is where I've been largely studying now in subsequent years, the art is just phenomenal and prolific. And by the end of that, I was hooked and really curious to know more. What I found was that it had been a really under-researched area of this ancient aspect of Aboriginal culture.
And why had it been so overlooked in terms of, let's say, archaeological or rock art research?
I think that it goes back to the whole question of the colonization process. I think that it's an issue that's familiar to many in North America as well as here, I'm sure. I think that there was the notion that to recognize the richness and depth of that ancient Aboriginal culture, which persists to today, I think that there was a notion that that should be ignored because, I mean, Australia was occupied on the basis that it was terra nullius, that there was no one here, which is a complete fiction. So there was a downplaying, if you like, I think, of aspects of Aboriginal culture. So,
Was there any native people still living there, or had they been exterminated or sort of died from introduced diseases?
No, that's the outstanding thing, and that's been the biggest single aspect of our work, I guess, since my initial introduction, was that we do all of our work with the local community, and it's their ancestors who painted this art. So we go out on country with, in particular, the Kwini people. This area comes under a native title determination, which is the Balangara country. And one particular subgroup within that is the Kwini group. And we work with Kwini people every time we go out on country and take samples. We talk to them about the samples that we take. And they are most of those, the Kwini people now, live in a community called Kalumburu, which is about 500 people.
So the Kwini are about 500 people. And do they possess a fair amount of indigenous knowledge, pre-contact knowledge?
I think that's, yes, they do. Yes, they do. Like everybody, of course, they've been through traumatic times where, we hear in other parts of Australia and the world, you know, where disease and violence and warfare, probably killed out sort of 90% of the population.
Of course.
And then after that, there was a missionary period which had sort of further deleterious effects on maintenance of culture. But they've survived.
What do the Kwini feel or mean or think about this interest in their ancient past?
The way it works in Australia is that we can really only work on their country if they invite us there. So it's within their culture, their notion of working out how old rock art is sort of in calendar years, it has no real relevance, but that's what I do. I date rock art.
But they don't care how old it is. That's not relevant to them, correct?
No, because the oldest rock art has been there forever and going back
in their culture.
In their cosmology, yes. But what the young fellas tell us, the young men who take visitors out on country and show them rock art, the question that the young Indigenous guys keep getting asked by tourists and visitors is, how old is it and what does it mean? You know, the two perennial questions.
Right, the big questions.
Yeah, so I think they understand, the community there understands that to communicate the richness of their culture to other cultures, there are certain sort of benchmarks, and calendar years is one of those things. Calendar years is one of those aspects, or antiquity of the art is one of those things that we use to put it into perspective to other things that were happening around the world.
Do they have the elders or those that have embraced or have knowledge of their pre-contact religious ways, have any deep or interesting thoughts about theology or cosmology that relate to these rock art sites?
Yes, they do. It's, of course, an area that I'm not qualified to talk about. It's such a deep and rich culture that for those of us that weren't raised in that culture, we can only sort of get a glimmer of what's going on. We get a hint of it, but we lack the background, the experience, all of the paradigms go to make up those aspects of Aboriginal culture to allow us to fully understand those things. But they do, they, if you like, that when I go out with, for example, Augustine and Engo, Augie and Engo is the senior elder for one of these areas, and he will tell us, he will give us like the kiddies version of the story of a particular panel and the paintings on that panel. So he'll tell us about the rainbow serpent and where they came from. They came from one part and they go to another part. So he will share with us the, if you like, a simplified version of the stories that go with the most recent art.
Well, that's rather remarkable, don't you think? Which he's particularly familiar with.
I mean, it is, and it just adds a richness, an incredible depth to the research that we do, and it gives it a meaning beyond, you know, what the science normally would achieve.
Okay, well let's stop it there, and we'll hit the next segment and go deeper into your research. See you on the flip flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And this is episode 144, the second segment, and we're honored and blessed to be speaking with one of the most knowledgeable people from the Australian realm on rock art dating, and sometimes it's called, you know, geochronology as well. Damien, give it a shot. Tell me how you ever got involved with this particular specialization that you've pioneered.
When I came to the view that the Aboriginal rock art was sort of an under-researched area, I thought, well, I'd like to know more about it, because there were some publications that had been written by earlier researchers who'd spent most of a lifetime out on country searching and recording rock art sites, guys like Graham Walsh and David Welsh. But their work was limited to documenting the various styles of rock art, and based on superimposition of one type of rock art over a style over another, one painting painted over the top of the other, they came to the view that there was a sequence of painted rock art styles, but they, no one knew how old it was. And I thought, that's interesting. With a background in science and engineering, then I went off to study a master's degree in archaeological science at the Australian National University, because the ANU had a very good track record in research into Australian archaeology and rock art. And then through that work, I realised that the particular area of rock art dating was one that maybe we could make an impact. There's some things that hadn't been tried, many things that had been tried, but there were some that hadn't been tried, and I thought, that might be worth a go.
This area of rock art dating is probably one of the most challenging all around the world, and one of the more difficult areas. I've been involved some of this, as others have as well, of course. But that is a question that is asked, as you said, one of the million-dollar questions. How old is it and what does it mean? And the how old is it, especially for rock art, is extremely testy, because, of course, we have often little to work with in terms of dating, and we've had to pioneer some new and innovative and sometimes rather controversial ways of attempting to develop direct dates. Am I correct?
Absolutely, yes. It's a scientific minefield.
Tell me what you mean by a minefield. Why is it a minefield?
I think it's because people have taken a desperate attempt to apply dates based on too little information or too little evidence. And so I think I was aware of this long history of various controversies around dating rock art. So I thought, well, if we're going to do anything, it's got to be on a big scale, and we have to have a method that's pretty robust. And
what had people said about this rock art that you were attempting to date? What did they believe in terms of its antiquity? That's always sort of a great question to think about.
Yes, there are various views.
Sure.
There was But of course, there, because we know there are, based on this earlier research that I mentioned, because there are a range of styles, people were of the styles, yes, different styles of painting. For example, the style of paintings that was known to be the oldest, because you only ever see other styles of paintings painted over the top of it. Mm-hmm. So you look at the paintings sort of at the bottom, underneath all those other layers of paint, and people like Graham Moore said, okay, well, there's a particular style, and he defined it as lots of animals and some plants drawn in outline form, then with a sort of a dashed or irregular lines infilling that in a dark brown sort of pigment. So he characterized those styles, and that was said to be the oldest one, and there was speculation that that dated back to the time when people first arrived in Australia, which we now know to be probably at least 60,000 years ago.
My word, yeah.
But going back in time, because, you know, there was debate as to whether people had been here for more than 10,000 years, within my lifetime.
Yes, yes. When you talk about North America versus Australia, you have quite an enormous time range, that particular, you know, range of time is almost incomprehensible for anybody that is a specialist in North America, because it's at least three times as old as anything we have here in the States.
Yes, certainly enormous equity. And the astounding thing in the area where we've been working, as I mentioned before, is that as far as we can tell from the DNA evidence, the people that are living on country now in that general area are the people whose ancestors did these paintings.
It's a direct line of the genetic evidence, correct?
So that seems to be what the genetic evidence suggests. So there was a great deal of controversy, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. because people were suggesting that this art was so different, it must have been painted by someone else, which our dating just doesn't bear that out.
No.
So the dating work has been able to establish an antiquity which sort of is more consistent with the DNA evidence.
So were there any attempts at direct dating these rock art sites previously?
Not for the older styles. Only the most recent of the five main styles. It's only the most recent one, which is the last few thousand years, where a pigment has been used, which sometimes contains charcoal. Mm-hmm. And we can radiocarbon date charcoal very reliably, although it's not quite that easy. But in the older styles, the ochre is always one of the iron oxides, like a hematite. And no one anywhere in the world knows how to date that. We don't even have a suggestion of a method for dating the pigment. But even if you could date the pigment, that's not what we really want to know. What we really want to know is when that pigment was ground up and mixed with some sort of binder, perhaps, and applied to the wall. You know, that's a different question altogether. So the approach that we did, that I took, the possibility that I saw was that we find mud wasp nests often overlying and sometimes underlying these paintings. And when you look at, mud wasps are prevalent sort of throughout much of the world. I saw some evidence of extensive mud wasp nest building over the top of Venezuelan rock art recently. But certainly in northern Australia, that's what we get. We get mud wasps building their nests over the top of rock art. And the idea was, okay, there are many, many examples where we have mud wasp nests over the top of rock art. And even though it doesn't directly date the painting, if you date enough mud wasp nests over the top or underneath paintings, then eventually you will statistically be able to establish that you have a certain level of confidence that the painting must be older than X, for example.
Exactly, yeah. So you could bracket that and find the centrum, if you will, of the most likely age of the painting. Now, I've done a few trips down in Baja California and looked at these great mural rock art sites. I don't know if you're familiar with those or not. They're supposed to be some of the largest prehistoric paintings in the world. And they have mud wasps, at least I believe they have mud wasps nests over them. I think I've seen what you're talking about. And I thought about that when I saw those particular paintings. And that's just a sidebar because I think that might be of interest.
Yes, I look for, whenever I see photos of rock art from around the world, I immediately focus on the mud wasp nest. But, but of course, we tend to record and publish images of the most pristine rock art.
Yes.
Mud wasp nests tend to degrade the appearance of rock art, so they tend not to feature. But fortunately for me, they're pretty common because in our work over the sort of a 10-year period, we've managed to collect over 600 wasp nests that either over the top or underneath Kimberley rock art.
So you spent 10 years doing this research?
Absolutely, yeah. After I finished my master's degree in 2012, I went looking for a PhD supervisor. And fortunately for me, I found Andy Glitto and Janet Hircht, my supervisor, PhD supervisors at the University of Melbourne. And they got funding for a project to date Kimberley rock art. And I knocked on their door for about a year, and eventually they agreed to take me on as a somewhat unconventionally qualified mature-age PhD student. So.
And at that point, did they have an anticipation that you were going to be doing this type of research?
Yes, I put a proposal to them to talk about radiocarbon dating. In particular, they'd assembled a team of geochronologists, Bert Roberts, who's a world famous geochronologist in the area of optically stimulated luminescence, and a variety of people who specialized in various techniques. And so I said, well, you know, how about I do the radiocarbon part of the piece of the work? And that's what I did from 2014 until 2020.
Did they anticipate you going for those wasp nests?
We had two main targets. There's either wasp nests or carbon-based mineral accretions that grow over the top or underneath. And in the end, it was my colleague Helen Green has continued the work on radiocarbon dating of the accretions, and I've focused since the last 10 years on radiocarbon dating of the mud wasp nests.
Well, let's stop it there. And we'll get into the details of this extraordinary research. See you on the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. We're in the third and final segment of the Rock Art Podcast, where we're talking to our colleague, Damien Finch, Dr. Finch from Australia, about his work in dating rock art. Fascinating, fascinating project. Damien, it's all yours. Let's see what we can dig in a little further on the details and nuances of your efforts.
Yeah, sure.
So when did you begin? You said it's a 10-year project.
Yes. In a project, which is a sort of an Australian Research Council project, was approved or funded from 2014.
Wow.
In conjunction with some funding that was not only from the Australian Research Council, but partners that included the Ballingar Aboriginal Corporation and Rock Art Australia, a philanthropic organisation that funded a big chunk of the work that I've been doing in related areas.
Yeah. What a wonderful, way to spend a decade of your efforts.
Yes. So that project the University of Melbourne was leading was, as I say, it used a number of different techniques to try and get a handle on dating rock art of the Kimberley region. And the mud wasp nest technique proved to be successful because in Australia we've got the Australian National Scientific and Technology Organisation, which is, apart from other things, they run Australia's only nuclear reactor. But they are the organisation that has some of the most expensive and the most technically advanced sort of equipment, particularly in the area of accelerated mass spectrometry.
Oh, AMS, yeah.
An AMS is what you need to radiocarbon date the sort of samples that I had. And fortunately, the experts at ANSTO are really world class when it comes to dating microgram sizes, you know, samples of carbon. Because
so what's a microgram? Is it the size of a fingernail or the edge of a fingernail?
I'll start with the wasp nest itself. So the wasp nest that we collect, the average size of that is around about 250 milligrams. So for people that don't speak metric, but basically if a teaspoon of sugar is four grams, then 250 milligrams, the average size of the wasp nest sample, there's 16 of those that would make up a teaspoon of sugar. So you were starting with something that's very small.
And really small. Really small.
Really small. And what we're talking about really is mud, which is the sediment that the wasp is collecting from the bottom of the rock shelter, usually very local. But fortunately for us, there's a lot of wildfire burning occurs in the Kimberley and has done so for millennia. And charcoal gets blown into this same sediment. So, of course, the amount of charcoal that gets blown in is quite minuscule. So we're starting with something that's fairly small, and then the charcoal concentration within that is very small. So on average, we end up with 25 or so millionths of a gram of carbon.
Oh, my word. I had no idea. Oh, my word. It's just nothing.
Right. It's nothing, and that's the average size. You know, if there's, we're really pushing at the limits, ANSTO's limits in terms of what can be reliably dated, and we believe, and we've shown that we can reliably date down to 10 millionths of a gram of carbon. So if it's less than 10, we tend to discount that result. And so eventually radiocarbon dated over the period from up until 2023, so nearly 10 years.
So how do you extract that small, tiny, infinitesimal, tiny amount of charcoal from these wasp nests?
What we do is there's other sources of carbon in there that I want to get rid of.
Okay.
There's accretions and things. There's an organic process that generates other carbon-bearing compounds. Because these wasp nests are sitting in these open rock shelters for 20 and 30,000 years. So the oldest nests are coated with all sorts of stuff. And so I use a range of mechanical, physical, and chemical techniques to try and remove the sources of unwanted carbon. So that's the accretions that grow on the outside, the oxalate minerals that form, carbon in this form of charcoal that gets blown onto the nests, and the plant matter and anything else that might have been included at the time. So basically that's a physical process, grinding away the outside, a chemical process, part of which was established, you know, as a standard ABA protocol, acid-base-acid protocol that's used to date charcoal and get rid of contaminants. That's the big thing. The carbon's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. You've got to try and just isolate this carbon that you want to date, and we use those sorts of...
So you go through this elaborate exercise of trying to get what you are confident is the original carbon that would be associated with some sort of an actual incident that would help us to date the rock art.
Yes. And fortunately for us, we did some tests. We measured the radiocarbon, we measured the age of the carbon compounds in newly constructed nests. So we went up there deliberately to see nests constructed. Because it may be, if you were getting charcoal in those new nests that were, say, 10,000 years old, then the technique would not be useful because we wouldn't really, you know, the inbuilt age would be indeterminate. But
So you demonstrated that those new nests has charcoal with a reasonable age that is synchronic with its episode of being fashioned.
Within a couple of hundred years, yes.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic.
We narrowed it down to about 200 years on average. And that gives us a level of uncertainty that we're more than happy to live with, given that we're talking tens of thousands of years.
So then you got to do that to all these nests and all these rock art sites over 10 years.
Yes. And ANSTO then takes the samples that we clean up at the University of Melbourne, and then ANSTO takes those and puts them into one particular AMS machine that's been optimized for measuring microgram size. So between us,
you started to put how many samples?
Well, we radiocarbon dated 600. There's been 600 radiocarbon measurements that they've done in that period. A lot of those are replicates, you know, where we measure something twice, where we do blanks and standards. We do things where we know that this should be, you know, a million years old, so we've got to prove that it's more than 50 or 60. So in the end, we ended up with about 430 really reliable dates on wasp nests that were in contact with rock art, either under or over it.
And so then you get the results, right? The AMS dates. Yeah, what did they show you? So you were getting them all across that 10-year period or no?
Yes, and toward the end of my PhD, we published the first series of publications, which...
Okay.
On and particularly on the oldest period of rock art, the so-called irregular infill animal period, which is the animal-centric paintings. And then the second oldest period is called the Guillaume period, with these highly decorated human figures. And we published in 2020, we published dates on the Guillaume period figures, but we'd only had about 20 or 30 sort of reliable dates on each of those periods. But we were able to show that those results were usefully reliable for even a relatively small sample. And in a couple of cases, one that we published in 2021 in Nature Human Behaviour, it was dated three nests that were over the top of a painting of a kangaroo and three nests that were underneath that same painting of a kangaroo. This is a huge, it's 2 meters long, so what is that, on a ceiling of a rock shelter. And we got an age bracket in that particular case. This is a bit unusual, but normally we just get over or under, not both. But with this age bracket, we were able to determine that that kangaroo was between about 17,100 and 17,500 years old. So with a median value of 17,300. So and when we published that, that was the oldest sort of intact painting that had ever been dated in Australia based on the ages of those wasp nests.
So you had about 7,000-8,000 year record?
So that was the oldest one, was 17 year.
For what time span was this Guillaume style activated and associated with your dating?
Well, that's what I've spent sort of the last 5 years doing. Because that's what we want to know. We don't want to know just a particular painting, how old that is, most of the time we just get a result that it says it's over 5,000 years, it's over 7,000, it's over 15,000, whatever it might be.
How old it is.
Yeah, and to do that, you have to think about it statistically. It's the same problem as trying to determine when people first arrived in the US or in Australia. You know, we go in and we date, in the case of Australia, I can speak with a bit more authority, you date evidence of human activity. And over 30 years, more and more excavations and dates are achieved. Exactly. So
what was the bracket, the time span, when this Guillaume period was prominent?
The Guillaume being the second oldest period, we established in the 2020 paper that style seemed to have proliferated 12,000 years ago.
Wow.
Whereas the older period, the irregular infill animal period, which is a mouthful, that's closer to 15 to 17,000 years ago.
Wow. Oh, my word. Fantastic.
So they're the estimates that we've been fine-tuning since then. And
associated with that earlier period dating as well?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that's right.
So you dated the 15 to 17,000 and the 12 to 7 or so, and then you pinpointed what was going on with that oldest style and the one after it.
That's right.
And, fantastic.
And since then, we've now got dates on the three younger style. We've got ages that haven't been published yet.
This is for the Kimberleys, right?
Yes, that's right. This is just for the Kimberley region, specifically for the Queenie country within.
Well, it sounds like it's a lifetime adventure. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, well, it's going to. We need a few more younger recruits so that it can
exactly,
be more than
one. Recruit them.
Yeah, so. it's decades of work, and we it's always.
Decades. Oh my!
Yeah, word. We always knew there would be, but the good thing is that for young researchers coming on board now, we've got a method that we know works.
And they have their hands full once they get involved.
That's right. They can come on board, proven method, just, you know, spend 10 years out in the field collecting samples.
I guess I'm going to have to hold it there. Do you have any closing insights, wisdom, or things that the people that listen to this podcast might really want to know, or you'd want them to know? How's that?
I think that it's unusual around the world to be able to talk confidently about the age of old, ancient rock art styles. And
absolutely.
So I think that what we'll be showing with this next round of publications, building on what we published in 2020-2021, is that people were painting quite elaborate figures up to 20,000 years ago in Australia, and they painted in that style for probably, you know, 5,000 years, and then switched to a totally different style from the animal-focused paintings to the highly decorated human figures. And the transition between the two seems to coincide with a dramatic change in climate.
Mm.
Through at a time after the last ice age, after the last glacial maximum. So now we can see that the change of styles corresponds to a change in climate. And that's exactly what you want to do with rock art.
That's fantastic. What an amazing discovery. We're going to have to close it on that.
Thanks, Alan.
I am honored and blessed to have you as a contributor to the Rock Art podcast. And thank you for your insights and wisdom. God bless you.
Absolute pleasure.
See you on the flip-flop, gang. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.